You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to our final episode on integrating disease-modifying therapies in the management of Alzheimer's disease, hosted by Med Learning Group. Our overarching goal is to support primary care physicians, neurologists, psychiatrists, geriatricians, and other multidisciplinary team members who care for patients with Alzheimer's. This podcast series is focused on timely screening and diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment and early Alzheimer's, and the integration of disease-modifying treatments in clinical practice. My name is Surabhi Dangi Garimella, and I'll be your host for today's podcast. In our prior episodes, we heard the primary care, neurology, and geriatrics perspectives on screening, diagnosing, and managing MCI and early AD. In this final episode, we will gain insight into the importance of geriatric psychiatry in diagnosis and management, as well as education and counseling of patients and caregivers for shared decision-making. With that, it's my pleasure to introduce and welcome our program chair, Dr. George Grossberg, and our guest expert, Dr. Sandra Swantek.
So it's great to have Dr. Sandra Swantek, who's a leader in American psychogeriatrics with us. And Sandy, thank you for joining us for this podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here, Dr. Grossberg.
Great. You can call me George. That's okay. We know each other well enough. But I want to start off with a case from our clinic, which is probably not all that different than the cases that you encounter. And it's a 72-year-old gentleman who's a high school principal, came to our memory clinic, basically accompanied by his wife and adult daughter. The family was concerned because they had noted changes in his recent memory over the past 6 to 12 months. He was misplacing things, for example. He was getting frustrated by that. They were also concerned that he was kind of requiring more help with balancing the checkbook, requiring more help in making kind of financial or investment decisions. These were all fairly new. They also cited that recently his wife asked him to go to the supermarket to pick up a few items. He went to the supermarket and came back without the items that he was supposed to get because he had forgotten those. And then the daughter was also concerned that at times more recently during family gatherings, he would get the names of his grandkids kind of mixed up. And that didn't happen previously as well. Now, interestingly and importantly, there were no reported problems at work. So he continues to work full time as a high school principal. And he was also independent, according to him and the family, in all of his basic activities of daily living. There was some family history on his side. His father, when he was in his 70s, was diagnosed with what we used to call senile dementia in those days. We don't know what type. Medical history, you know, very typical for someone his age. He had well-controlled hypertension, hyperlipidemia, osteoarthritis, reflux disease, and allergic rhinitis. Medications, again, were fairly typical. He was on lisinopril hydrochlorothiazide for his blood pressure. He was on a statin for lipids. He would take extra strength acetaminophen if he had any pain. He was on famotidine for reflux, cetirizine for allergies. And he took a couple of vitamin supplements. He was on vitamin D3 and a B-complex multivitamin. No alcohol or substance use history, no marijuana gummies, none of that. And on mental status, he actually looked pretty good. He was alert. He had clear, goal-directed speech. We did notice that at times he would look to his wife when we'd ask him questions. He would answer the question, but he wasn't always sure about the answer. So he would look to his wife, you know, for confirmation, the look-to sign. He was not clinically depressed. He wasn't particularly anxious, definitely not psychotic. His physical and neurological exam were unremarkable. His vital signs were good. Interestingly, his smell test, which is part of our neuro exam, he didn't do very well on that. It was 0 out of 3. We do the St. Louis University mental status, the SLUMS, which is very similar to the MoCA and the Mini-Mental, and he scored a 25 out of 30. On the PHQ-9, he only scored a 2, and the Barthel, which is, we use that for ADLs, the family fills that out, they rated him as being 100% independent as far as activities of daily living. We ordered some blood work, a CMP, a CBC, TSH, B12, folate, homocysteine, C-reactive protein, all were within normal limits. We ordered a brain MRI without contrast. Again, typical changes, some small vessel disease subcortically, but nothing really out of the ordinary for someone his age. So I guess the first question, you know, Sandy, is, you know, just to give us your comments or your thoughts about this case and what are kind of possible next steps that you might take with someone like this?
Well, this gentleman is certainly like many of the patients I see in my clinic. He is beginning to have some difficulties, but it's nothing that it's nothing that is getting in the way significantly of daily living. But people who are very familiar with him are noticing a change and wondering what's going on, and is this indicative of a problem? Mild cognitive impairment usually presents with very mild symptoms like this that aren't significantly impairing or getting in the way of everyday activities. The first thing I do with someone like this is to look at their medicines, because one of our first concerns is to identify and remove medications that may be getting in the way of his remembering. And those would primarily be medications that we call anticholinergics, or medications that reduce cholinergic activity in the brain. He's not really taking anything that's strongly anticholinergic. Sometimes an antihistamine can be the most anticholinergic medication that someone is taking, but the medication he's taking is not particularly known as a strong anticholinergic medication. So we've ruled out medications at first glance. We look at his blood work and doesn't sound like he had any significant findings there either. And what I'd be looking for first and foremost there is this gentleman suffering from an anemia that hasn't been diagnosed? Is he suffering from a vitamin deficiency, such as a vitamin B12 deficiency? Is his thyroid okay? And from what you're describing, that blood work is all pretty much normal. So in the face of that, then we begin thinking about a very early neurodegenerative disease or a mild cognitive impairment that's not at this point significantly impairing him. The prevalence of mild cognitive impairment among folks that are living in the community, age 50 or older, is about 15%. And then it goes up to approximately 20% for folks over age 65. We have to recognize that age, gender, and education can influence the prevalence of mild cognitive impairment.
Now, are you seeing more, do you think, not just you, but geriatric psychiatrists, are you seeing more early disease, MCI, due to Alzheimer's disease or very early Alzheimer's dementia? And if you are, how are you handling these referrals or more of these cases?
I think that as the awareness of families, community members has increased over the last decade, we are seeing more. People are picking up on the subtle clues much earlier than they used to. And so I do see, and my colleagues are receiving requests for evaluations for people that are barely showing any impairment, but families and the patient themselves is aware that there's an increased risk if you have a certain history, a family history of dementia, or a history of certain diseases. And so people are looking for it. And yes, we are identifying, we're diagnosing folks much earlier in the course of the disease. And I think part of it is also that people are aware that there are medications available that might do something to help them with the disease process.
So we're going to get into the disease-modifying therapies, which are kind of a new advance in treating MCI patients due to Alzheimer's disease or those with very early Alzheimer's dementia. But I'm also wondering, you and just in general, where do geriatric psychiatrists get most of their referrals?
It's the patient and the families that calling and requesting evaluation. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, it would be from internal medicine and family medicine doctors. Sometimes it's from neurologists. Sometimes it's from psychologists. Sometimes those referrals come from social workers. I think it really depends on the knowledge base of the practitioner. Mm-hmm. You know, some, for example, some physicians have had much more training. Younger physicians tend to have more training in identifying folks with early cognitive impairment. As opposed to somebody who's been in practice maybe 30 years, and this wasn't something that they necessarily were taught about when they were in medical school or their postgraduate training. Mm-hmm. So really, my referrals come from all over the place.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. You know, we do too. We get those same kind of referrals, but we also get referrals from neurologists. Because, you know, people often say, well, gee, Alzheimer's disease, neurologists should be comfortable and confident in diagnosing it and treating it. But the reality is, I think, as you know, that neurologists often specialize. Mm-hmm. And I have a number of colleagues in neurology who do stroke. They send their dementia patients to me or to us as mm-hmm. geriatric psychiatrists. I have ones that specialize in movement disorders, but don't do Alzheimer's work. Those that might do epilepsy and so on. So it's really a broad group. But that brings into question too is, how do you see, let's say, the role of geriatric psychiatry differing or being similar to what a general neurologist who does do Alzheimer's work would provide?
What I've seen in my practice is even the neurologists who are familiar with diagnosis and treatment of cognitive impairment will refer to me when the patient has some sort of behavioral disturbance, when there is agitation, the presence of a significant depression, severe anxiety. Even the neurologist specialized in identifying and treating cognitive impairment will refer to me at that point. I think geriatric psychiatrists are particularly well-suited and well-trained in the evaluation and management of some of the more severe behavioral disturbances that often will accompany major neurocognitive disorder or dementia as the illness progresses.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And we get those kinds of referrals as well from very capable neurology colleagues who are very capable and adept at diagnosing various neurocognitive disorders and treating the neurocognitive disorder. But when it comes to the patient who's overtly psychotic or seriously depressed or agitated, aggressive, out of control, then they often will call off. So that makes a lot of sense.
There's another issue here as well. I think as the awareness of this disease process has grown in the past years, we certainly have many very fine Alzheimer's disease centers across the nation. And there certainly is one that I've actually worked in, and there are several others in the community that I'm in. And one of the challenges we face is that it can take as long as 6 months to get an appointment in one of those major centers, and families desperate for a diagnosis and some kind of intervention will, when they can't get quickly into a major center, start looking for other clinicians in the community who have a reputation and there's some demonstration that they have that skill set. And that will drive patients into the office of a a solo practicing geriatric psychiatrist.
Yeah, so that makes a lot of good sense as well. Now, you mentioned earlier in the case that I cited from our clinic that in patients like that, one of the things you always want to do is kind of review their medications, looking for anything that might impair cognition, whether it's anticholinergics or benzos or narcotic analgesics, things that are on the kind of beers list. I think that's very important. What are the other conditions that you see sometimes that might present with early cognitive changes, which would not necessarily be MCI due to Alzheimer's disease?
Well, we look for untreated or inadequately treated depression. We know that an individual suffering from depression will often have cognitive problems. That can be one of the major symptoms of depression. That depression doesn't rule out the presence of a cognitive impairment, but it can interfere with memory. The other illness we look for is untreated anxiety disorder, or an anxiety disorder that's been treated with benzodiazepines, because we know that the illness and that medication can interfere with memory and therefore function. We look for a B12 deficiency that can interfere with language and thus memory as well. We look at whether or not the patient's had a stroke, and where that stroke was located, because sometimes vascular disease can interfere with memory, depending on where that stroke occurred.
So you do a very thorough evaluation. I think that would be one of the advantages of going to a setting like your clinic. But I wanted to ask you next to maybe wear two hats. Wear your specialist hat as a geriatric psychiatrist, but let's talk about the other hat being psychiatrists in the community, general psychiatrists. How do you see the role of both groups in not just diagnosing, because let's say they do have someone already well worked up and diagnosed with MCI due to Alzheimer's disease or very early Alzheimer's disease dementia. How do you see their roles and their comfort levels in perhaps discussing, maybe recommending, monitoring, and so on, the new disease-modifying therapies?
It is my personal belief, and actually one of my missions, to help all psychiatrists, regardless of their specialty, to be able to recognize cognitive impairment, evaluate, and initiate treatment. I think that's a responsibility for everyone that calls themselves a psychiatrist and who has any kind of interaction with older adults. I've worked for a number of years to train general psychiatry residents in the ability to do a comprehensive workup and initiate treatment on the patients that they see. I think we all need to have the vocabulary and the skills, simply because there are so many older adults that the number of geriatric psychiatrists that we have in this country is insufficient to the size of the population that's looking for evaluation and treatment.
Yeah. So related to all this, just like in your clinic and what you do, how do you discuss kind of the benefits and risks of disease-modifying therapy with potentially eligible or interested patients, as well as, you know, family that may accompany them?
Well, with oral medications, which we've had for a number of years now, actually, oftentimes the patient and family comes in asking for a pill because they've heard of the pills. And I begin that discussion by explaining to them that there are pills. They are not going to stop the disease. They're not going to cure the disease, but they will perhaps slow down the progress of the disease. And I explain that without medication, they're generally speaking, I use the tests, we use a Montreal cognitive assessment is what I generally start with. And we know from studies in the past that if we were looking at the mini mental status exam, on the mini mental, folks will lose approximately 4 points on the mini mental per year if they're progressing towards an Alzheimer's like disorder. With treatment, we can slow that loss down to less than 4 points per year, maybe even 0 to 2 points.
Talking about the symptomatic therapies, but
yes,
we know, yeah, but as we know, we don't currently have any symptomatic therapies that are FDA approved for mild cognitive impairment. They are approved for the different stages of Alzheimer's dementia, but I'd like you to focus specifically on the monoclonals, which are considered to be disease modifying therapies, and the kind of patient, both from your perspective as well as a general psychiatrist perspective. And I appreciate your kind of describing your role as someone that needs to really educate the generalists, because there aren't enough of us geriatric psychiatrists around, that's for sure. But whether it's you or them, if the patient and or the family is interested in a monoclonal antibody and they seem to be appropriate, how do you approach or how do you describe the benefit versus the risk issues with those drugs?
Well, I begin by explaining that the monoclonal drugs have the potential for removing the amyloid or amyloid plaques that we believe are causing the disease or causing the cognitive impairment, and that these are now available. They may be useful, they may be helpful, but they are accompanied by some significant side effects. I explained to them that committing to these medications or this infusion therapy is going to mean staying in town and coming in for an infusion every couple of weeks. And for many families alone, having to stay in town for the length of the therapy is in and of itself a barrier for them, because they're traveling, they're doing things, they're going to see the grandchildren on the other side of the country. And so I want to make sure before we even go here that they understand that this is an ongoing treatment that requires them to come in and have an IV infusion every few weeks, depending on which medication they're going to be taking. I want them to know that it's not a miracle, that they may not see complete resolution of their cognitive troubles. They may see a modest slowing of the cognitive and or functional decline, but it's not a miracle. And this treatment comes with a risk of something called ARIA, or the way I describe it is brain swelling, brain inflammation, or brain bleeds. We're not guaranteeing that's going to happen either, but there's a significant risk with any of these medications that they could have that complication. And then I also discuss the cost, because there is a significant cost associated with these medications. Some families are good with all of it, and some families, the minute I start talking about cost, they're out of the picture.
Yeah, and of course, the patient themselves has to understand the benefit-risk ratio and has to be able to say, I want it. Otherwise, we can't administer it. So let's assume that, you know, patients are on a monoclonal. How do you monitor a response, or how do you kind of find out if the patient's benefiting or not? Do you use any scales, or do you mostly use patient and family input? What do you utilize to monitor?
Well, With any treatment, monitoring involves repeat cognitive testing. It also involves repeat brain imaging. And of course, it involves the report of the patient themselves and their family. And, you know, this is, these treatments, the monoclonal treatments are not something that we would consider doing in a small private practice. I mean, these patients require referral to a center or a practice that has, I would say, a multidisciplinary approach to the treatment and has that built-in evaluation into the treatment itself.
Yeah, I like the concept you just mentioned of the kind of the notion of the multidisciplinary approach. And I guess the question is, what's the role of geriatric psychiatry as part of that team, as part of that multidisciplinary approach? How do you see that?
I've been involved in the early stages of the evaluation and diagnosis, and then in the follow-up in the months following that diagnosis. I think with any treatment and with any diagnosis as serious as cognitive impairment, a lot of emotions, a lot of feelings are raised, a lot of concerns. There can be fear, both for the patient and their family member. A spouse is going to approach this or experience this differently than, say, a son or a daughter or a brother or sister. Lots of things come up. Lots of anxieties come up. The patient themselves may become depressed. Their anxiety may be increased. They may get into the treatment and decide they don't want it. Same thing could happen for a family member. So all these issues need to be addressed. And the psychiatrist, the geriatric psychiatrist, certainly has the skills to help the patient and the family explore this. Also, the skills to explain what's going on and help them understand the treatment itself and their response to the treatment.
I think those are really, really excellent points. And I think also point out, I guess, a unique strength of psychiatry and geriatric psychiatry, which is not just to see the patient as our kind of identified patient, but also to look at the care partner as maybe our, I've called it the second patient. They're under a lot of stress and they could get depressed. They could get burned out. They could become anxious. They might need more help. They might need social services or other intervention. And I think we as psychiatrists and geriatric psychiatrists are kind of specially trained to be attuned to those needs and to be able to address those needs as well.
The treatment doesn't work unless everybody, and that means the patient and the people in their circle, the caregivers, the children, are involved and on board.
So everybody has to be on board. Now, I think that's a great line. So it's been great having the outgoing president of the American Association for Geriatric Psychiatry. So thank you, Sandy, for being with us. I really appreciate it. And thank you for the excellent messages to everyone.
Great being with you, George. Take care.
Thank you, Dr. Grossberg and Dr. Swantek, for highlighting the diagnostic challenges with MCI due to early AD and the importance of shared decision-making in care management. And thanks to all of you for joining. We hope you've had the opportunity to listen to all of our podcasts in this series, emphasizing the importance of multidisciplinary approach in AD diagnosis and treatment. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group, who, in support of improving patient care, is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. The CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. And thank you to Lilly for providing an educational grant for this activity.